I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Feminismus mit Vorsatz, the podcast around feminist perspectives with me, Laura. If you don't know the podcast because you don't speak German, and while this is the very first English episode, let me introduce myself. My name is Laura Vorsatz. I'm from Berlin. I just turned 32 years, and for about 4 years now, I'm documenting my very own journey into a feminist perspective in this podcast. The reason? I discovered feminism in my mid-20s, and I think that's quite late for such a beautiful and world-changing movement. I wanted younger people to discover it earlier than me by giving them a hand and showing listeners around the world of feminisms. Of which key moments do feminists think when they recap situations where they realize that people are not equal at all? Can feminists still wear nail polish? Can men be feminists? And what about having a family? Or does every respectable feminist need to be a badass boss now? I ask myself through these questions by interviewing other feminists and watching and reading and listening to everything I could find, and discovered that intersectional feminism suits best for the change I want to see in the world. In the last months, I broadened my horizon by traveling to Lebanon in the so-called Middle East and speaking to various activists there. In this episode, we are talking about the feminist journey of Sara Kadura. She is a feminist organizer and activist and, very important, she is the founder of YouTube channel Haki Nasavi, which means feminist talk in Arabic. I think her approach can be compared to mine. She explains a lot of interesting topics around feminisms in a well-researched and calm way. For example, she talks about the right to abortion, so-called honor killings, liberal feminism, virginity, or Islamic feminism. You can watch the Arabic videos with subtitles on YouTube. I love talking to Sara. She taught me a lot about her growing up in a conservative, mostly Muslim area in Lebanon and being a Palestinian refugee in the third generation. We talked about wearing the hijab and the struggle of taking it off after some years, about the relationship to her single mother, and of course about her feminist uprising and the reactions to her YouTube channel. At some points during the interview, I had the urge to add some thoughts. This sound will announce them. And as always in these episodes about feminists in action, we start with a small piece of audio which describes the beginning of the feminist journey of Sara Kadura. So when it comes to your feminist journey, why does it start with the sound of a busy street?
I think for me, it's because I was raised by a single mom, and I remember what it was like being raised by a woman who also did not fit society's standards of what a respectable housewife and widow particularly. So I was raised with this model of a mother who, when walking the street, would sometimes hear people talking about her because she had a sense of mobility and freedom that widows are not expected to have, especially as a woman who was already married. Now people would look at her as if, you know, she was respected, part of a family, and now she doesn't have that anymore. So she needs to be more conservative. She needs to be a strong mother in a patriarchal sense, and all her worries and dreams should be around her children without having a life of her own. So that's what I remember, walking with my mother as a child, or just knowing that when my mother walked the streets, some people look at her because she doesn't fit that model in their head.
Dear listeners, if the sound seems to be awkward from time to time, I'm very sorry, but actually this is the overwhelming outcome of an audio rescue situation. Because apart from doing this in English the first time, I did what every good podcaster must do in their career. During the interview, I forgot to push the record button. Most of what you hear is the magic of an artificial intelligence tool which optimized the backup on my smartphone as good as possible. So thanks to AI, and back to the conversation with Sarah.
And can you tell me more about this context where you grew up? So where are these streets we heard? So I grew up in a conservative city that feels like a town. It's called Saida. It's in South Lebanon. There's some kind of dominance that some religious groups have in there. They also work as like surveillance groups. And something happened recently, a few days ago, where a woman and her partner were sunbathing on the beach in Saida, and she was wearing a bathing suit, and she was harassed by a couple of religious figures who told her, "This is not how we do things in Saida. You should go to your city," whatever. And she was like, "I'm from this city, and I come here every day or every weekend." And so this resulted in like a discussion and debate and issue about what women get to do in these spaces and who owns these public spaces. So eventually the religious, I don't know what to call them. I think they were sheikhs. Eventually they were put in their place because a lot of people want to change the city and want to make it more secular and more accepting of different cultures and different religious backgrounds. So growing up in that city had a lot of impact on me because I felt watched. Like, the neighborhood is a space where a lot of men and teenage boys find themselves spending the most time in. Like, the street is theirs to an extent. And I used to play when I was a child in the street, you know, playing tennis or different games with other kids. But when you reach a certain age, you do not do that anymore because this, like, public space is not yours to claim. And so I felt this sense of guardianship when I went out with friends. Some of my friends were boys, teen boys from the neighborhood, would tell my brothers, "Oh, I saw your sister hugging a male friend." And my brothers would also, you know, come back to me and tell me, "You embarrassed us, or this is not acceptable here." And I remember in particular an incident where we had this stupid event. It was taking place in different cities in Lebanon, and it was a free hugs event that was trendy at the time. We were holding free hug signs and, you know, it's kids trying to do something fun and connect with the other cities in Lebanon. And after that event, a lot of people reached out, a lot of people hugged us, but we had fun. And then later in the day, a religious group releases a statement that we've seen this happening and these are not our morals and we do not accept this kind of perverted behavior. This is not the image of our city. And I remember I was so terrified. I was 15 or 16, thinking that I participated in this very innocent event, and it led to a statement that was threatening in tone. So I was terrified for a week after. Nothing happened eventually, but the fact that these things happen and these people feel like they own these spaces and can tell people what to do and what not to do is terrifying. I also felt watched in terms of, like, you know, writing my opinions on Facebook or other social media, because also people would send screenshots to my mom or my uncles or whatever. If I, for example, posted something about, you know, LGBTQ issues, that was still very controversial when I was growing up. Hopefully these things are changing, but this is like the context that I grew up in. And so one of my biggest dreams growing up is just to move to the capital, even if, you know, I had friends that I loved in the city and I had my family and, you know, I wanted to be connected to the city, but I felt like the city is not providing that connection because I either had to fit within a specific mold of what a good girl is within this environment, or break away from this mold and kind of accept the consequences.
You told that you already posted about LGBTQ rights, for example, when you were living in Saida. How did you discover this other world, I would say?
So I would say I grew up on the internet. It was at that time, maybe from grade 9, the internet was already available. And so I spent a lot of time with myself in my room discovering things over the internet. We had Tumblr at some point, which was, you know, the big thing. And I think that's where I learned a lot about sexuality and feminism and so on. And I, you know, it was fascinating at first, but I didn't understand why it was so demonized and why people had to suffer consequences of their sexuality or gender identity. And it was an interesting thing because also being exposed to that on the internet allowed me to kind of be able to have those discussions with my mother as well growing up. And I think she also changed in terms of her opinion about these things and understanding of what it means to be LGBTQ or what sexuality is and diversity and sexuality and gender. Because also our exposure to that in Lebanon particularly was always through TV shows that focus on controversy and sensational issues. And they would, you know, it's a talk show where they bring a lesbian woman and, you know, make it such a big deal. Oh, you are a lesbian. Why do you love women? What do you do in bed? These are the shows that were exposed to the public because they got views, but they further demonized people from different sexual identities. And at the same time, they opened the space for, you know, people watching at home to have discussions about them. And I made use of that to have discussion with my mother and brothers to kind of try to challenge different things about their opinion and what they grew up with.
Talking about your mother, it reminds me that usually I ask my interviewees about a question I should ask the next interviewee. And the last one, she's a feminist from Germany, Theresa Bücker. She asked, how do you see the generation of your mother and what do you wish your mother's generation had done? What do you think about that?
It's a lovely question. Growing up, I had a lot of like internal conversations and struggles with myself regarding my relationship with my mother, because at the beginning, I used to blame her a lot for how society treated her. I wanted her to be proper. I wanted her to fit this mold so that I don't have to go through that. I don't have to hear bad things about her. And I don't have to be the child or the daughter of this woman who a lot of people viewed negatively. And really, when I say negatively, it's for the silliest things. It's not even a big deal how she lived her life. Like, you need to be all about family. You shouldn't be, you know, seen in public engaging with men who are not like directly your family or laughing or marrying. Again, she also got married years after my father passed. That also puts a lot of widows in a very sensitive place with society because they want the widow to be only dedicated to her children. So I blamed her and I hated her at times because I felt like I was exposed to this like bad mouthing of my mother that I did not choose. But today I feel like if it wasn't for my mom, you know, living her life as she wants, I don't think I would have been able to do the same for myself. She set an example for me that regardless of what people say, you can do what you want. You can be who you are, make your own choices as long as you know what you want. And obviously she doesn't agree with everything I do, but regardless, it's the sentiment and the ability to see someone breaking out of this mold. So I think in terms of what I wish my mother's generation would have done, I would say I wish they were a bit kinder to their daughters because a lot of women live their lives in secret or, you know, they do not get to live their lives as well after they get married or have children. And even though they feel these things are unfair, not being able to, you know, do what they want. And really for so many women, there's no choice but to say yes or do what their family requires of them. On one hand, I understand that mothers can be punished for how much freedom they give their daughters in a conservative patriarchal society. On the other hand, I just wish more mothers were kinder and accepting of their daughters and at least even in a sneaky way provided some space for the daughters to be themselves, because I think they either fear the consequences of being bad mothers according to society, or they simply fear that they would lose whatever protection they get from being in line with patriarchy. Because when you're in line with patriarchy, you get a sense of security and protection from the men in your life. Otherwise, you feel like you are weak or exposed to blame and punishment and so on. So I think that's one thing I would wish that my mother's generation managed to do.
You're talking about patriarchy, but of course, Zaida is also a religious conservative city or town. How did this interfere in your growing up?
I was pretty religious when I was growing up, for maybe until my 13th or 14th years. That's where I grew up in. And also after my father passed, my mother wasn't able to get back to work. So we were registered in some like orphan organizations. I'm not sure what the right term is in English, but in Islam, there's a duty for people who have money to provide for orphans. Part of it includes having activities for children. I used to do theater in one of the organizations, and other places it was more about being involved in like receiving lectures or workshops that were religious in nature, or what it means to be like a good person, or what it means to have a good lifestyle in accordance with Islam. So I was taught a lot about Islam, and I used to go to a mosque to also study the Quran and study a lot of religious teachings. And also at some point I was teaching in Birkit. So I had a lot of faith growing up. And then I started struggling with that in the middle of my teenage years, because I started feeling that there's a falling out between what I started believing in and the ideas I was getting exposed to and the questions that I had about life. On one hand, and the religious teaching that I was receiving on the other, because what I was receiving was pretty strict and not accepting of a lot of things. And it taught me how to be a girl or a woman in a way that I did not feel comfortable with. So I was asking more questions. I was asking my mother. I was asking the religious teachers and the organizations. I was asking at my school. And I was, you know, I was included in discussions online with other people from different cultures as well. So I started losing faith when I wasn't finding answers that I felt were sufficient or I felt made sense. And I also wear the hijab when I was younger, and I wore it by choice. I really wanted to wear it. A lot of women and girls around me wore it, and I thought it's pretty, and I also wanted to be closer to God. But then I realized at some point, I cannot take it off. I did not have the same choice. I had the choice to put it on, but when it came to taking it off, I wasn't allowed for a while. I was told, you know, you made this decision, you need to stick with it. Even though I was a young teenager when I made this decision. So I felt stuck in something that I didn't want. You know, if I had the faith, this would not mean anything to me. I would be able to live my life. But when I was losing my faith, it felt like prison. And so around my late teenage years, I was already kind of losing faith. And maybe by 18 or 19, I started considering myself not religious or atheist or agnostic. And I don't even know what the difference is today.
I didn't know neither, but I did my homework. Atheism means the lack of belief in the existence of God or gods. And agnosticism, on the other hand, is the belief that the existence of a god or gods is unknown or unknowable. Agnostics claim that it is impossible to prove or disprove the existence of a higher power, and emphasizes the limitations of human knowledge.
Religion became to me a factor of oppression rather than what it meant to me before, a factor of, you know, relief and connection and community. And it was very important for me to announce that I'm not religious at that point, because it felt like I was challenging the patriarchy of religion in my area. But now that I'm outside of Saida and I have my own life and everything, I don't think about religion, to be honest. But yeah, it had a lot to do with also being a woman and being limited in my mobility and my choices and all of that, and being told, oh, it's because religion says so every time I ask a question about anything I'm curious about.
Mm-hmm. And what were these questions you asked?
So some of the questions revolve around why, as a woman, I'm expected to do some things that men are not expected to do, like covering myself, dressing up in a certain way, even when it was not convenient at all, in the heat or whatever. It just didn't make sense to me that it was a requirement. I also had a lot of questions about the different stories that I grew up with, different stories about different prophets and messengers and stuff like that, and miracles. In Islam, we are taught that these are literal stories. I think in some other religions, some interpretations say that, you know, miracles and messenger stories and prophet stories are more metaphorical, but in Islam, we're taught these are very literal stories, and a lot of it did not make sense to me, and a lot of it felt sexist or homophobic or whatever. And it was also who had power today in terms of religious teachings. Women were always followers and not interpreters and scholars of their own. And who had power in the mosque or in religious platforms were always men. And so I also felt very uncomfortable with that. And I didn't understand why this discrimination existed, you know, within a religion that was based, according to what I learned, on justice and equality and mercy. And also about, you know, just having no space to have a personal relationship with God without abiding by all these rules that in many places felt oppressive to me. I felt like I can't have that personal relationship.
Yeah, it is such a shame when you think about that believing should just be the relation to God. And when you put all these surroundings, it makes it not possible to have this relation. So before you talked about influences via the internet, for example, Tumblr blogs, do you have some examples for me from the internet, or maybe also people or locations that influenced you and on your feminist journey?
As a late teenager, there was a girl who started doing vlogs. She was Jordanian, and she started posting videos of herself talking about harassment and talking about different forms of discrimination against women. I honestly do not remember her name, but I remember being very taken back by her because I felt, oh, this girl is very courageous. I know Jordanian society is also very conservative, but this girl is posting herself online and talking in a very, you know, she was angry, but also she was poised. And she was saying all the things that I was thinking about. And she was pissing off men in the comments. And that felt very liberating because the Arabic-speaking internet, particularly, was also a space and a platform for a lot of men, mainly. You know, they took up a lot of space online. And so I felt very fascinated by this girl, and I wanted to be like her. I wanted to be like her at some point and be brave enough to exist online, regardless of like all the online harassment that she was receiving. And when I got a scholarship, I went to a university that had, I think, the biggest library in Lebanon at LEU. And suddenly I had access to all these books and all these, you know, classes that were very critical. And I wouldn't have had this opportunity if I did not get a scholarship. I would have probably been still stuck inside. But I came to Beirut, and suddenly all these professors were asking us very critical questions. And we were having discussions that I wouldn't have had in any other place, particularly because I was studying social sciences. And I and two of my friends co-founded a club called Intersection and Feminist Club. And we used to do like some panel discussions and events and stuff like that, and meet and greet and talking about like what feminism means to each of us. And that was my introduction to the feminist scene in Lebanon and feminist organizing. And from there, I started joining different groups and being more active in a, I guess, grassroots way rather than just reading and being exposed to things as a recipient.
Was that also the first time where you called yourself a feminist?
I think I started calling myself a feminist after I learned about this term online. Even though I didn't exactly know what that means or different schools or whatever, to me it meant that I recognize that there's oppression and discrimination and I do not accept it, and I want liberation and freedom for women. And it's a simple definition, but it resonated a lot with the anger that I felt at the time and that I still feel.
also sounds like it, that you already had an intersectional perspective on it from the very first beginning when you were saying it's the fight against any oppression. It's,
I hope so.
Yeah, because when you're saying that this club is about intersectionality, you're like, oh, wow, okay, interesting already. Because I don't know, for me, intersectional feminism was not the first feminism I discovered.
Yeah, that's true. At the time, it was starting to become a more mainstream word, or people were starting to use it more often. And when we started the club, we also were from different backgrounds. I am a Palestinian refugee in Lebanon, and so I am discriminated against by law, whether it's labor law or political laws and whatnot. And the two other friends were also discriminated against in terms of their gender or sexuality. And so we came together from a place where we already understood how different identities or different systems intersect in our oppression. And the fact that I'm a woman means I am discriminated against, but also that I'm a refugee. It's a double kind of oppression, and similarly to my friends. So we came from a place that was also very real and very raw, because that was our experience, and we found the answer to that in intersectional feminism.
Yeah, makes sense. But can you enlighten me, what are the discriminations in Lebanon against refugees?
It's a very funny thing, because I'm a third-generation refugee, which sounds ridiculous.
Yeah.
But both my grandparents were evicted from Palestine in 1948.
Palestine in 1948. What happened? Palestinians call it Nakba, which is an Arabic word that translates to catastrophe or disaster. It refers to the events during the 1948 Arab-Israeli war from the Palestinian perspective. So the Nakba describes the displacement, the dispossession, and the suffering of the Palestinian population during and following the founding of the State of Israel. So Sarah's grandparents were forced to flee or were expelled from their homes and lands, like around 7,000 other Palestinians who became refugees looking for refuge in neighboring countries, for example in Lebanon. I learned about this term, the Nakba, to be honest, quite recently, as in Germany I was more exposed to the Israeli side of the story. So if you never heard about Nakba, you are not alone. But I think it's always better not to only know about one perspective.
There's a lot of conflict around citizenship in Lebanon and in other places for refugees. So Palestinian refugees who came from Palestine were put in camps in different places, and they were not allowed to get a citizenship in Lebanon because there's the scapegoat of, you will return to Palestine one day, so we're not going to give you rights or recognition here. And so this refugee identity just passes through generations. So I didn't grow up in a camp, but both of my parents did, and my grandparents lived in camps. And so I still have that card. I'm not allowed to become Lebanese, even though I lived all of my life here. And I don't need to become Lebanese. I identify as a Palestinian, but there are very legal discriminations against Palestinian refugees. And particularly, you're not allowed to practice a lot of jobs. Any job that requires a syndicate, Palestinians are not allowed to be part of. So that means, you know, doctors, engineers, pharmacists, whatever. It's a long list. And also, obviously, politically, we're not allowed to vote. Or we don't have any right to political participation. We cannot own property. And there's generally the discourse against refugees, and now also with Syrian refugees as well. There's like a lot of xenophobia. And when it comes to financial crisis, for example, the economic crisis in Lebanon, the ruling system always blames the influx of refugees for that. And lately, there's been also more racist and xenophobic attacks and discourse in Lebanon. So it's a fun experience. But also, refugees are classed or viewed in a certain way, like because I have colored eyes and I dress in a certain way, people somehow don't assume that I'm Palestinian, except when they see my cards, and that when they start discriminating. But for some reason, Lebanese people think that, you know, refugees are all brown or, you know, dress a certain way or are all poor. So these are the people who get discriminated against the most socially as well.
Okay. Well, yeah, and the Syrians can have less professional paths as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
They are limited to things like agriculture and then like.
Yeah, that's crazy. Because I ask a taxi driver if he thinks that's normal. I don't know if he thinks that's good. And she was, of course, they are not Lebanese. Blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay. Interesting perspective to see it like that.
On a quick note, the podcast lives with you and you and you as listeners and can only continue to exist and spread its message if you help. For example, you can now rate a podcast in your podcast app, recommend it via messenger or social media to your friends and family, or support it financially via PayPal, direct bank transfer, or a membership on Steady. As always, you can find the links in the show notes. Also, I'd like to announce that the shop where you can buy Feminismus mit Vorsatz socks in black, white and violet is available again. Check it out on iraklebt.de.
I have a little, game is maybe exaggerated to call it like this, but let's say experiment where I give you like the first part of a sentence and you fill the rest.
Okay.
So the game is called The Last Time.
Okay.
And the aim is to remember situations where you felt like this the last time. Okay, so I'm starting with the last time I was thinking, others have the same struggle like me, was when?
I would say yesterday. We were talking about therapy and we were talking about what it's like as women who work specifically within women's rights organizations, who like we have our own struggles with oppression, but also we're working on them from a professionalized kind of way. And that really complicates the relationship you have with work. But we don't have a lot of choice throughout the economic crisis. We don't have a lot of choice of where we can start over, because I think for us women who especially were activists in the first place and were feminists in the first place, we got stuck in a place where everything we wanted to work on relates to the patriarchy and the oppression of women, while, let's say, people who were not struggling with that specifically had the space and energy and the luxury of exploring other professions. So, yeah, I think obviously this affects our mental health and burnout and relationship to work and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
The last time an angry feminist I was when...
I feel like it was recent. It's so hard to remember because of how often that happens. One example I can think of is one of my closest friends. I know my friend struggled a lot with her family when it comes to bodily autonomy and the choices she can make. I think a lot of women in our society end up choosing marriage because it feels like a way out, especially when they end up with men who are a bit more liberal or open-minded than their parents. So I was at my friend's, I think, last week, and I remember her family were so kind to me. They were really nice. They were, you know, giving me compliments about my tattoos and about my dress, but at the same time, I was remembering how, for her, as part of that family, it was a different experience. Because from what I knew about her experience, I expected them to treat me differently, but I guess it was a reminder that things really differ when someone is part of your family.
Okay. The last time I pretended to be stronger than I actually was when...
My partner has been going through some difficult time health-wise, and I feel like sometimes relationships and what you go through during a relationship is a bit too individualized or isolated. It was a period where I felt like I need to put on a strong face and pretend that I have everything, like I'm on top of things. But yeah, eventually I cracked. Because even when I don't believe that things need to be this isolated within like a couple or a small family, I mean, here in our community, things were a bit more communal. but they are changing. Like a lot of women and a lot of like young people started moving outside of their family houses and going to the cities and becoming more independent. And like the shape of these relationships and families became a bit more individualized. So I think for a lot of women, we get stuck in a cycle of, I need to be on top of my shit, I guess. And that sometimes means that we get burned out because we don't ask for help, because we also internalize the idea that I should be able to do this. I can be invincible in those situations. So that was maybe like a week ago.
Thank you for sharing. I can absolutely relate to this. The last time I celebrated a personal or social success was when?
I received a fellowship, I think 2 months ago or a month ago. It's also from a German organization. I applied as Hakina Saweda YouTube platform, and they've been really cool so far. The other fellows, they do really fantastic work in their own countries. It's a bit global. And I was really excited to learn about like the different work they do in their respective countries. They're very diverse, but all relate to feminism and queerness and social change.
So true. I strongly recommend scrolling through the other projects of the Risk Taker Fellowship. Digital education for undocumented migrant women, feminist science fiction, online comics about the future of the internet in the Middle East and North Africa, and so on.
So that was really cool because it's the kind of support that lets me do my own thing with the channel while having a kind of like stable income for a year. I think that's the last thing I celebrated.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I saw the project. Yeah. It's the Risk Taker Fellowship, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's cool. The one.
Cool. Very nice.
And when you started your YouTube channel, how were the reactions?
Interesting. So I started the channel during quarantine because I had a lot of time on my hands. And at the beginning, it was very amateurish kind of filming. I just had my phone and I just cut the 2 segments and that was it. And like over time, it started improving a little bit. I was also learning a lot in terms of editing and production. But yeah, in terms of reaction, it's really like a lot of people loved it from the beginning, and mainly people who identified as feminists. Over time, when I started getting more exposure and some of the topics were getting a bit more, controversial, the kind of feedback varied. Like I had family members send videos of mine to my mother going like, oh, do you know your daughter is talking about this? Particularly this one video about virginity and another about, I think, sexuality, even though they were pretty mild. But yeah, this pattern of people sending videos, particularly like family members to my mom, was very annoying. It wasn't a reaction I wanted, because like, if you want to complain about this, talk to me directly. Why do you need to put my mom in the middle and make her feel bad? It's the same thing again, you know, you're a bad mother because you allowed your daughter to do this and that. So I think those were my least favorite reactions. And there was one on also Islamic feminism. And these videos are very tricky for people who are not exposed to these ideas. So they got traction from a lot of people that do not necessarily view my videos. And lots of comments were, you know, harassing and just, you know, calling me a whore or, you know, a bad person trying to throw us other girls and ruin society and stuff like that. But these are expected reactions. And I don't, honestly, today, I don't really care for these comments. I don't think they affect me the same at all. But to me, the reactions are overwhelmingly positive.
Could you bring me back to the situation or to the discussions around the video about Islamic feminism? What were the questions the audience had, or what was the problem, or maybe even the positive side? Maybe there were also people who just discovered that there is something like Islamic feminism.
So I think this happens with, I would say, a lot of different belief systems, that there's openness to reform in different ways, but when it comes to, let's say, women or sexual and gender minorities, it becomes difficult, or it becomes more open to, not open to discussion, actually more open to criticism and negativity. And it's the same case with Islamic feminism. There's been a lot of thinkers and sociologists who are Muslim, are women in majority, and are also feminists or human or women right defenders. And they saw the chance to reform. And others also saw the chance to delve more into history and interpretations of religious beliefs and traditions to kind of contextualize them, especially when it comes to teachings around women and women's rights. And there's brilliant work done by those thinkers. Specifically, my favorite is Fatima Bennisi. She's Moroccan, and she did really amazing work on reinterpreting different stories and also a collection of stories and oral history from like Muslim history that is usually, you know, kept under the surface.
Islamic feminists argue that Islam as a religion actually supports justice, compassion, and equality. Maybe that's as surprising for you as it was for me. Why? Because throughout history, traditional Islamic texts were mostly interpreted by men in the context of patriarchy. This, and of course conservative culture, overshadowed what Islam could actually be. By reinterpreting these traditional Islamic texts through a feminist lens, gender equality can be lived within the context of Islam. Fatima Bennisi was one of the most important voices of modern Islamic feminism. Throughout her career, she argued that many cultural restrictions imposed on women in Islamic societies were not inherent to Islam itself, but rather stemmed from these patriarchal interpretations.
She and others do this kind of work because they want to bridge together people's beliefs and the context they live in with freedom and justice and rights. And these studies or these works of reinterpretation do not come out of the blue. They are very well done. And reading them for the first time and being introduced to this word was very fascinating and groundbreaking for me, because I did not think that was possible. I always felt like I need to be not religious or atheist or whatever to be feminist. And I still am, but I feel like a lot of people who have a lot of faith end up feeling like they need to let go of one identity or the other to live peacefully or be accepted within one community or the other. So I think this work is important. And I think it's also important because it challenges notions that we've grown to accept. So I think it's one of those schools that is, you know, very local and very regional. It was born from this area or from Muslim-dominated area, but they're not as well known for obvious reasons. Like the most of these thinkers had to leave their countries or were blacklisted or their books were not put out in the public. A lot of people were, I'd say, pleasantly surprised that this kind of school exists. A lot of feminists were also not accepting of it because their experience and my experience, I wouldn't say I had a good experience with religion, but because they experienced oppression directly through like religious teachings. I understand also why a lot of feminists were like, don't try to beautify Islam or religion. We don't need that. And I understand the sentiment completely. But as any other topic I cover on the platform, I think it deserves space. And a lot of people, I would say, would find a lot of pleasure and enjoyment in reading. So I'm reading a book at the moment, another book by Fatima Bennisi about women sultans or women khalifas or leaders throughout history.
The Forgotten Queens of Islam, that's the title of the book, tells, you can guess it, the stories of queens or female rulers within Islamic history. For example, the story about Queen Zubaydah, who once dreamed about a place in paradise with abundant water while Baghdad experienced water shortages. We are in the 9th century and she, as the wife of political and religious leader Harun al-Rashid, got inspired by this dream and took it upon herself to solve the water problem. So known for her dedication to public welfare, she started a massive water project, which took several years to complete and involved thousands of workers and remarkable engineering knowledge, because it involved digging tunnels and creating a system of underground canals to transport the water from the source to Baghdad. It is safe to say that without Queen Zubeda's vision and dedication, the construction of the canal may not have taken place.
That's something that I was never exposed to, whether they were directly, you know, leading Muslim civilizations or were indirectly doing that, and the kind of conversations and discussions that were taking place around that because they were women. So a lot of our history is hidden away from us because men have the power to narrate this history.
Is there a feminist challenge which you would name as your biggest or as a biggest?
Especially for younger feminists, I think what they get exposed to the most is about independence. And I think sometimes that comes across as not needing others and paving your own way. And that's is usually important when it comes to the challenge that you have with your family, if they're standing in your way and you need some sort of economic independence, let's say, to be able to be freed from like the shackles of the family or in order for your relationship with them to change. But the discourse around independence becomes a bit too alienating for me, or at least growing up, I felt like I don't think humans should be entirely independent. I think we all need each other and we need community. And instead of always being against, needing each other because the relationships that we had growing up might have been harmful, we should at least look out for different ways of connecting with each other and creating, let's say, alternative families or alternative communities, and to not be afraid of wanting help from each other. Being independent in one way does not mean you need to get your shit together 100% of the time and pretend that you're not, you know, struggling or in pain or whatever. So I think for a while it was hard for me because I felt like I need to be that first example, and struggling on my own did not help. So I'm accepting that, you know, independence in a feminist sense is not about living isolated from community. Instead, there is joy in community and there's joy in care.
Mm-hmm. For which feminist change is it never too late?
Damn it. I am not sure, because I'm going through my own, you know, feminist crisis, I feel.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that I feel I had a bit more hope maybe years ago. I feel like this relates to the context in Lebanon in specific, because before the crisis, there were more feminist spaces to be part of and spaces to also meet other feminists and other people who work on social justice and social change. And that's been kind of absent in the last few years since the crisis. It feels like those spaces don't exist anymore. So it's hard to imagine a feminist movement in Lebanon at the moment for me, because most things exist online, which was fine when it was complemented with also action on the ground. So I'm going through that crisis of feeling like this migration to online spaces is not as beneficial as we thought it would be. Instead, it becomes like a social media kind of movement that I feel is very limited. So this like absence left a lot of space for like having reflections on what was going wrong and what was going right. So this makes me feel like what is missing when a movement crumbles, you know, immediately when you don't have the physical space? What is missing? What have we not predicted, or how were we not equipped? Of course, things weren't predictable, but, you know, it's not good to blame ourselves. But at the same time, it feels like we're starting all over again. And it feels like younger generations also are coming into a space that feels empty and are also starting all over again, which feels like, you know, shit, this is exhausting. But yeah, I used to find this strange when I was younger, but now I understand it a bit more, that I feel like it shouldn't be too late to have cross-generational conversation around feminism, what has been done, what has been tried, what have we learned, and stuff like that, in order to be able to move forward without, you know, repeating the same mistakes or patterns in Lebanon specifically.
And when you focus on your own projects, what will the future bring?
Hopefully, I'll have a bit more motivation to keep doing things. I think even though I started the channel with quarantine, by the end of it, let's say, and by last year even, I felt depleted as well, because I started it because I was inspired and I felt like there's a lot to talk about. And there's been like 2 years of feeling, oh, where's everyone, you know? I'm not being inspired by anything. I'm kind of forcing myself to do this work. So I hope I get that excitement again, because I don't want to feel like I'm doing this to stay relevant. I want to feel like I'm doing this because, you know, I'm seeing things and I'm being inspired and I feel like I'm having great conversations and I want to put them out there and I'm learning from actual experience rather than reading up in my room alone and trying to, you know, convey things. So yeah, I'm hoping to get that excitement back and I'm kind of working on it. And I hope I reach a place where I feel like I've covered what I wanted to cover. I've created an archive of information and knowledge for people to look back at and to learn from. I think that's one of the most important goals for me. So yeah, I would say that's it mainly.
I hope it helps when I say that you already did a huge archive. I mean, and of course with the subtitles, you can watch it everywhere. So yeah. Maybe you have to concentrate a little bit more. I have to admit, it needs some focus to follow, but it's possible. Okay, so my last question would be, which question should I ask the next guest?
I guess my question would be, in your context, in your country, within your movement, what is the form of organizing that you feel is very important to start or to focus on? Because I think this is a question here right now, like with the ending of a lot of different groups. So I'd be interested to know what someone else in a different, you know, context feels is the perfect present mode of organizing, what the world needs right now, what the country needs right now.
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by organizing?
Like, if you were to create a group, a feminist group right now, what kind of group would you be creating? What kind of things would you be focusing on? What do you feel the country needs right now from you as feminists? So yeah, for example, here I would say something that has to do with relating feminism to also livelihood, like parties or groups that used to provide, let's say, kitchens for the homeless, whatever, relating, you know, the theory to everyday struggles of people. I feel like it's needed right now because there's crisis.
And if it's a guest in the context here?
Of course,
same.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a lovely conversation. I enjoy the questions.
That's nice. That's it. Thanks to Sara Kadura, thanks to AI, which rescued the audio, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to support my work through donations, sending love letters, rating the podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcast, or following me on Instagram. Feminismus mit Vorsatz Podcast is the name of the channel. The next episode will be in German again. I'm going to speak with Maximiliane Hecke from my favorite podcast Feuer und Brot about our pregnancies. Quite exciting, at least for us, so stay tuned. I remain, as always, with feministisch vorsätzlichen Grüßen, which is hard to translate. Intentional feminist greetings? Well, stay rebellious. Bye und tschüss.